Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hope everyone is having a great start of September and transition into the long Labor Day weekend. With that in mind, I thought I would share a recording I made with my good friends Will Jarvis and Lars Doucet. They host a podcast called Narratives. They were in Austin, so we sat down and recorded a decently long episode, going back and forth on a bunch of topics. Their podcast is broadly interested in stories around progress. So not only can I recommend the Narratives podcast, but I can also say I think you guys will get a kick out of this conversation. With that said, we'll be back on Friday with our normal programming and hope everyone has a great weekend.
Well, Marshall, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing really well. It's cool to do this in person. I've not done in-person podcasting in just like months. I used to do this all the time, but everything now for me is mostly just Zoom. So this is actually pretty exciting.
This is awesome. Yeah. It's really cool. Well, thank you so much for having us down here in Austin. It's great to see you and just catch up a little bit. Marshall, do you mind giving us a brief bio and some of the big ideas you're interested in?
Yeah. So brief bio, I am a podcaster. I host a couple of podcasts. I host one called The Realignment, which is really about like American politics and trends and how the world is changing. Other one is Counterbalance. So it's like foreign policy, mostly focused on like defense. And finally, I do one for On Deck called The Deep End, which is the tech sector and how founders are operating.
Good deal. Good deal. Can you talk a little bit about, how you first got into The Realignment, recording the podcast, and the ideas behind The Realignment and what really interested you there?
Yeah, so two different answers to that question. So number one would be, I used to work at PBS, so I was working on a show called Firing Line, which was a reboot of William F. Buckley's show. And we launched it in 2018 with a new host, Margaret Hoover, Herbert Hoover's great-granddaughter. And what was crazy about that experience for me is the whole idea was like, hey, we're creating this show, debates, good faith conversation for a new generation. Yet it was done through PBS, aka the most legacy system possible.
Imaginable.
So the way I think about this is when you're programming a show like that, we would literally say to ourselves, okay, like the prime viewer for this show is a 68-year-old couple in Boulder, Colorado, who at 7 o'clock watches the news hour for an hour.
Right.
They then watch Washington Week. They've bought a bottle of red wine to split between the two of them. And then if we get a good lead-in / guest, they'll stick with you for 8:30. So all of those factors together does not produce something that is going to really like talk to like younger folks in general. At the same time, too, this is incredibly expensive. It's in person. It's New York. There's a unionized staff. Like all these like different bits. So it means that there's a lot of budget there.
Right.
So I do this for a year, and I start to realize, like, wait a second, like, podcasting in this format should be cheap.
Yes.
Right now, we're sitting with a
$100
Zoom set you bought once, and we're recording it. And what you could actually be doing with this idea of like good faith conversation is do it for cheap while also booking the same guests, which is what you can do with Zoom, like actually like online, because it meant that when someone doesn't have to go to your place, it makes it super easy to actually do it. So I raised a tiny bit of money, started podcasting, and just been doing it for the past 3 years. Two, and I really hope that's a real encouraging sign for folks who want to get into this space right now, because it seems so cheap to be like, well, like anyone could do anything now and like look at the wonders of tech. But it's actually just true, like unironically true. Like, it costs basically nothing to do these things. To the realignment idea, I've always been interested in politics like forever.
Yeah.
I was actually part of that like news hour at 7 p.m. at my household.
Yeah.
But I was basically never really satisfied with like the status quo. I'm like a super contrarian person. So like I was in blue Oregon, Portland specifically. So I was kind of like, oh, like I'm kind of like a moderate Republican. Exactly. And then like I moved to like Austin, Texas, and I'm like, okay, like I'm a moderate Democrat. I was basically like never really satisfied with like the specific labels and the way things were articulated. Exactly. So then this idea of a realignment really appealed to me. And the idea of a realignment basically is that during certain periods in political history, labels, ideas, figures, institutions are actually in a state of flux. And what they actually mean are just up for grabs.
Gotcha. That's cool. I'm curious, when you talk about the realignment, what in particular do you mean? Do you mean this like realignment of working class people from the, you know, central like Democrat kind of coalitions? I think about this in like kind of the Rust Belt states to Republican voters and Trump, or is it something different?
That's a part of it. So for example, like what you're talking about, like you're seeing the fact that the GOP is starting to perform better with working class voters in general. You're seeing the fact that the Democratic Party is doing better with college educated voters. Like, a way to think about this is, and this is crazy, if you think about today's politics, Ronald Reagan won college educated voters just outright in 1984, which is the exact opposite of what you really see today. Another example of this too is like a racial realignment. So you're seeing the fact that the GOP is starting to actually perform better with working class Hispanic voters in places like Texas, Ohio, et cetera, Wisconsin. I just did an episode on this. So like, that's an example of like specific demographic realignments. But at a narrative level, I'm also interested in like issue areas that are like redefining themselves. So a good way to think about that is the China issue. The way we thought about China basically before 2015 was entirely different. China is benign. It's something that we could like work with. It's something where we're maybe in competition with them, but that competition is friendly. Now it's much more aggressive. Now we're talking about Taiwan, those different bits. So that's not the technical definition of a realignment, but we should really think of it along those ends.
So there's the question of polarization, and then there's like this other like sense of realignment. Like, so polarization is like the things we're fighting about and on opposite sides of is different, and that can like rotate, is what you're saying. And then with the China issue, it feels like that seems a little more bipartisan to me. So like, are you talking about like a kind of shift in consensus as well, is the second way you're using that term?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, which is, in an ideal world, a realignment leads you to a new consensus. So a way of talking about like post-1990s politics is, it's been just constantly shifting between, hey, we want change, so let's go for Barack Obama. We want change, let's go for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. Oh, we didn't like that change, let's go back to Joe Biden. And then just constantly pendulum swinging. The China issue is one of the few issues where it has just taken itself to its final concluding point, which is, we are in an adversarial relationship with China. The debate is what we do with that. But ideally, across every single issue, we would get to some sort of consensus position whenever this realignment is complete.
Gotcha. What do you think special about China, the China issue in particular, that lent itself to, is because it's like an adversarial competing power? Is that why it lent itself to kind of this consensus in American politics about kind of our stance?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say it's that the issue is very empirical. So the worst realignment issues are issues that are moral, more like about like morality and like value judgment. So like with student loan forgiveness,
yeah,
there's a real debate there. It's not, I mean, obviously like there are numbers here, but there's a debate about forgiveness and a question about like who deserves what in society and what like the proper things that we need to really value. With China, it's very direct. The question is, okay, 92% of semiconductors come via Taiwan. Taiwan is a democracy. There's a huge set of like allied countries, whether it's like Japan or South Korea or Australia, that would be incredibly under threat if the Chinese were to invade Taiwan. That just means that there's actually, we're not debating the things and what they mean. The question is how you respond to them. So that's really why you can see, okay, we all can agree there's a China that's being aggressive towards Taiwan. That's why there is consensus. That's why you have Marsha Blackburn going, but also Ed Markey going. Ed Markey's the senator from Massachusetts. He's like a Green New Deal senator. Marsha Blackburn's like an anti-big tech Republican from Tennessee. They disagree on pretty much everything, but what they do agree on is this, like, okay, how do we respond to this threat? Like, once again, like this, I don't like the whole, like, we have lizard brains, so we don't want to focus. Like, I think that's like really lazy. It's a little too like Malcolm Gladwell 2000s-y, but I think there's just something to be said about like when things are direct and not up for grabs, you can respond and assess that.
So what are some examples historically of his successful realignments that have taken us to new consensus? So like, the first one that comes to mind is like World War II used to have like, you know, who was the aviator? Lindbergh?
Charles Lindbergh.
Yeah, yeah. He was very America first. I think even like openly pro-Nazi. And then like afterwards, like after 1945 and like the whole war and everything, like we were like super united around, you know, the choices we made in World War II. What are some examples of like what you would consider successful historical realignments that moved us to a new consensus?
Yeah, so I'll pick, there's a bunch of these. There's actually this great author called Frank DiStefano who's written a book on realignments. Some people really like his episodes on the realignment, so I suggest folks check those out. But two I'll pick out is, starting one, just the New Deal era. So I wouldn't just say like World War II. I would actually say that period of like 1932 through 1945, where you have the, you know, FDR administration forge a new consensus on both like the role of government in public life. So like that's once again, like whether or not you like the specific way that Social Security is structured, like whether or not you like have specific qualms with like New Deal programs, there was a way that the US thought of like the role of government before 1932.
Yeah.
FDR, his coalition, forge a consensus on that. And this relates to your Charles Lindbergh point. The other part of that consensus was America's role in the world and assuming the mantle of world leadership from the British after their empires, you know, obviously killed or given its death knell during World War II. So that is an example of how the next 45, 60 years, there are debates. So there's a debate about, do we privatize Social Security? Yes or no. There's a debate. Do we have Sweden and Finland enter into NATO? But the debate is not actually, oh, the US is going to go back to the way it was, where we are just like this island of tranquility away from the problems of Europe and Asia. So like that's the consensus. And I'd say the second one that things folks will probably think about because it relates, and both these realignments are helpful because they're also relating to challenges we have today. So the FDR period is useful because on the one hand, whereas this domestic debate, like how should the government approach student loans? How should we approach questions like healthcare? How should we address these issues of like public goods not being affordable? That's a debate about the side of the government. That's domestic. But then there's also a debate about what our role in the world should be. How should we respond to a rising China? How should we deal with Russian revanchism? Like those different bits. The second one would be the Industrial Revolution. So that period from like the 1890s to like the 1910s, where there's a debate of like, okay, so capitalism is really growing. The US is like clearly going to be like the leading economic power of the 20th century. How do we structure government to either enable and or restrain those forces? That's the progressives. Those are those different bits. Those are examples of how you had a world that looked different after they were done.
Gotcha. You mentioned FDR there, and I'm really curious. It, as a successful realignment and the New Deal and all this, like building this new government infrastructure. I get the sense that everyone in the New Deal, it's a bunch of young people kind of like us, and they would send us down, you know, rural Arkansas, electrify Arkansas, you know, here's a couple $1 million. Kind of like it tech now, where all the competent people seem to go into tech to build companies. Do you think it's and I get the sense that the American government does not work as well as it did when during the New Deal, when FDR was in power, and we were building these kind of federal infrastructures. Do you think that's true? And what do you think we can do to actually kind of improve American governance at this point?
It's a really interesting question, because if you take what you're saying literally, like, does the American government work better? Yeah, it obviously works better. Like, think about like the amount of like power and money and resources the American government has access to. So if I'm a pure, and this actually gets to the core of the dilemma, I would actually probably argue, with the exception of, you know, Obamacare, healthcare.gov, that disaster in 2013, $1 billion for a website that doesn't work. Actually, government works really well at what it's actually doing. Like we spend trillions of dollars, and it like works. Like we give payments to people during COVID. Like it works. I think what you're getting at, if you're taking the idea of what you're saying, is it feels like government cannot meet the challenges that are actually in fit. It can't actually do those things. So, for example, if I'm talking about how, well, actually, what are you talking about? Government works great. What I'm really saying is, during the Great Society period, government got into all sorts of places, welfare, aid to children, those bits, and government is still pretty good at doing that thing. Government's able to do those things, but that's not the challenge. The challenge right now is not like, how do we send people $2,000 checks? That's something we're actually very good at. The challenge is not like, hey, like how do we have like a multi-billion-dollar military that employs millions and millions of people? That's not the challenge. The challenge is, oh, hey, like our energy infrastructure is a disaster right now. Oh, it actually turns out that our government isn't effective at like controlling the price of healthcare. Oh, it feels like the society itself is stagnating. That's a different set of challenges than the one that I think our government is really set up for. So to your question of like, what do we really do about this? I think it's I just did an episode on Shinzo Abe, you know, the recently assassinated former Japanese prime minister. And I was reading the author who I spoke with, Tobias Harris, like wrote like the last biography of Shinzo Abe. And he was, you know, he lived in Japan. He's really studied him. And he talked about the speech that Shinzo Abe gave, where Shinzo Abe specifically said, quote, "My mission is to bring Japan to the level where it's ready for like the waves of the next 50 to 100 years. Which I just think is awesome. I think that's a great, just like if you're like in startup, like that's just like a great like mission statement for what a politician is. And I think that's what we're lacking from government right now. I think what we're lacking right now is, okay, like let's just like set up like what are the specific problems. And you can actually articulate most of these problems in a way that doesn't have to be like partisan. Like, it's not whether or not you like renewable energy or like oil and gas. Like, Texas's utility infrastructure is a disaster.
Right.
That's not up for debate. Like, there's no debate there.
Oh, I lived through it. Yeah. We had no power. We're like, where are we going to get water in?
Yeah.
No.
That doesn't have to be partisan. But what that could actually lead to is, and I think, and Catherine Boyle and I on our American Diamonds talked about this, like, I think the way we get through this is the current set of challenges like that is going to lead to newer generations of politicians who are responding to different incentives. So you're talking about like, oh, everyone's like going into tech. You've noticed this, like everyone in tech is talking about politics now. Tech is incredible. Tech is so political. Yeah. It's not even funny right now. And that existing is going to create new incentives. So,
and you're saying that's a change. Like 10 years ago, tech wasn't this politicized? Or you're not saying
exactly. So like tech was political and says that everything's political. So tech was giving money. People were going to join the Obama administration.
Sure.
But tech is interested in shaping narratives and the actual set of like, think about like imagine American politics as a chessboard. Tech is actually interested in shaping the actual nature of the pieces and where the pieces can move. Like, let's think of like Mayor Suarez. I think this got kind of superficial and isn't going to lead to anything bigger. But Mayor Suarez is like, hey, like, oh, wow. Like there are all these like tech founders and VCs who have a lot of money, a lot of resources, like big audiences. I'm just going to like say, how can I help? And I'm going to be like very friendly with them. And I'm going to talk about Bitcoin a lot. Is that going to lead somewhere like super game changing? Like probably not. Like look at the price of like Miami City coin. Right. But that is an example of how other politicians are going to start following that point.
Right.
So the reason why I love the American Dynamism episodes I do with Catherine is I always get so much feedback from non-political people. So like non-tech people are like, oh wow, like, that was like really interesting. I never like thought of that this way. You're going to start seeing more people respond to things in that dynamic. You're going to see people say, yeah, like I want to live in a more dynamic country. And that is an example of how it's just like nascent, but that's how I kind of think there's a way through.
Well, so this is a good segue to this half-baked idea I have about an internal realignment, because there's this general sense, I'm not sure if it's actually bears out, you know, to smart people like yourself, you can tell me if it's real, but like everyone I talk to feels like the national level of government is just like frozen, you know, filibuster every election. It's like 51-49 or 50-50, you know, and we're just sitting there getting nothing accomplished and nobody can get their way. So we can at least see if anyone was right. You know, all our presidential candidates are historically unpopular. It's always like the world's least popular candidate against the world's second least popular candidate, you know, and I feel like there's this energy of people like, well, we got to get stuff done somehow. So let's move it perpendicular to this axis of trying to get things done at a national level. And what you're talking about kind of like rhymes with that, this like notion of like tech getting interested in politics, that it's like, well, if the government's not going to do it, then like, let's start doing what we can with the levers of power that are available to us. What do you think of it, my half-baked idea of this internal realignment?
No, I agree with it. And I kind of would frame it as follows. The real question is like, where is like the center of gravity in American politics right now? So the way to think about this is that from post-FDR era, there were things like welfare reform in the 1990s where you had a lot of like innovation in the states, like Wisconsin. Tommy Thompson was the governor, partially influenced the way we reformed welfare. But like it's just all been about DC. And I think what's interesting right now is that whatever solves this national impasse, these different arguments, these different frames, like they are actually going to come from folks who are outside of the specifically like toxic like nature of like DC right now. So American dynamism isn't the answer to everything. But once again, I will say this again, I keep hearing from folks like left, right, and center how the idea is very interesting. That is an example of how you're having people who are outside of the specific gridlock and toxicity coming up with like different articulations. I also think at the same time, you're going to see an environment where if DC is gridlocked, then there's an opportunity to engage in places where things are not as gridlocked as well. It's kind of unfortunate that like Gavin Newsom is not a particularly like effective like presidential candidate, because there's just a world where you could see, okay, look, like Florida is just like a red state now.
Right.
It's controlled by Republicans. Like it or not, they have specific visions of how you should address education, how you should treat COVID, CRT, schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, culture wars. That's the red version. Then you got Gavin Newsom. California has like an opposite answer to every single one of these fronts. An interesting situation is you could really have like that California vision versus the Texas versus West Texas, because like Texas politicians for a variety of reasons can't go national as well. Yeah. But like, so it's really like Florida and California, just like those two visions. I think eventually you're going to basically see that happen. Like what happens when politicians are able to like uncontestedly, but actually I'm going to do something which isn't helpful on a podcast, like backtrack a bit.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Because this is actually kind of the reason why I actually don't believe this as much, especially on the Democratic side, is that, and this is actually why Texas is a really interesting state. I don't think states where any party has like one party control are going to produce the movements and figures who can win nationally. I did an episode with a guy named Peter Lydon about this, where he's like California. He did this piece, California is the future of American politics. Like Jack Dorsey retweeted it back in 2018. And his point is like, look at California. California is this dynamic part of the country. It tends to lead American politics. It gave us Barry, Reagan. Barry Goldwater performed well there in Orange County. It gave us Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was like a really prelude for Trump, not in terms of policy, but in terms of like, hey, this is a guy who's able to go outside the party system and take power. So we can think of California as the future. The reason why I say that isn't true is because California is not a competitive state. Any politician who rides to the top isn't actually competing in the spaces that require, that are actually like the center points of the political system. Yeah. So for example, if you are Kamala Harris has never had to grow up in an environment where Republicans could ever win. Kamala Harris isn't trained to give a good answer on CRT to a skeptical audience. Kamala Harris isn't actually really structured to engage in an environment where like you just generically could say whatever you want and have to play to your base. I know this in Oregon. Like Oregon's a state which is 100% blue. It's been there for a while. Yeah. It's going to stay there for a while, most likely. And that's an environment where you're selected for how do you rise up the party system?
Yeah.
How do you basically like wait your turn? States like Texas are interesting. As they get, I think the whole like blue Texas thing is like overstated, but like Beto's not doing too badly. It's purple. Like I think Matthew McConaughey probably would have stood more of a decent chance at winning. He was ahead of, Abbott by like over like 10 points. Once again, like that's like, once things start, it's different, but that says something. Matthew McConaughey, who was able to win the Democratic nomination and win the governorship of Texas, will get a better training in how to navigate the pressure points of like American politics. So like, okay, like guns are polarizing, abortion is polarizing. Yeah. How do I basically thread this needle while still getting a majority coalition?
Exactly.
Texas is an environment for that. New York City isn't, and California isn't. And Florida kind of is. So that's why it's a long answer, but I think that like, that's that part of it.
You said Florida is, but what I get from what you just said is perhaps we should be like long, like Glenn Youngkin, like the Virginia governor, and like short DeSantis at some level.
Exactly. No, that's actually a great way of putting it. I have a bunch of like conservative, like Hill staffer friends. Everyone has their group chats, and they're talking about how like they're just shocked at how well Glenn Youngkin has consistently navigated these moments. Like once again, he's like a Carlisle group, like super like rich dude, but he has been able to thread the needle on like CRT issues.
Right.
He's been able to like thread the needle on like, once again, like this isn't like an endorsement of his positions either, but like he's been able to like successfully like communicate these issues like very effectively. And that's like, that's actually a good point. Like Virginia is another good example where, and this gets to, I think like the broader toxicity of politics, like could Glenn Youngkin like win a Republican primary? At the presidential level, like probably not, but longer term, it's really those purple environment. And this is what Glenn Youngkin also gets better than a Charlie Baker and better than a, the governor of Maryland, whose name escapes me, which it really shouldn't. Because those are both Republican governors who are, leading in blue states, two different models. So those blue state Republican governors, what they have done is they effectively just govern as like center left moderates. Gotcha. Like that's the reality. The reality is the political classes on the Democratic side in both states are just very ossified and they're just boring. What they come in and do is say, look, here's the deal. You don't like the establishment on the Dem side, but like I'm safe. If you're Charlie Baker, you're a healthcare executive who's very much like this like country club Republican tradition. And then the governor is like centrist.
Right.
That isn't useful at a national level because like that's not like that's just like not the replicable situation. They effectively can govern by not having to make like those difficult choices. Glenn Youngkin is interesting because he's like a moderate by background who is still doing the tough thing, which is like making a choice.
Gotcha.
Which moderates don't like. As a moderate myself, like, we don't like doing that. Like, it's easy. Like, it's, okay. what Glenn Youngkin is saying is like, no, look, like, I read center right in terms of my affect, but like, actually, like, I'm a Republican, so that means that, like, I have to be like a pro-life person.
Right.
So he's saying, how do I articulate pro-life positions? How do I like talk about CRT without going all like Dan Bongino,
right?
But also just being like, I think this is like out of the norm. So like, that's another reason why it's kind of interesting. Because then the one other thing I'll add to this, and this is why I spend way too many episodes like going after Andrew Yang, way too many episodes. My editor was like, dude, like, we get it. My beef with people like Andrew Yang is like, that's what ineffective centrism looks like, which is basically like, oh, like, it's not that we have to make tough choices. And it's not that like there's this actually binary moment. It's that there could be all these other set of choices, and there actually just aren't.
Yeah. Yeah.
The reason why the abortion and gun debate issues and race and CRT issues are so like terrible, aside from like the actual facts,
right?
I mean, from a political perspective, is like, actually, there are just like two choices. Like, either it's too easy to get an abortion in this country,
exactly,
or there are too many abortions, or it's too like locked down.
Yeah.
Either there are too many guns in this country, or we need to have more restrictions on guns. Like, those are actually the only answers.
Binary.
It's binary. And I really beef with moderates and centrists who basically hoodwink people into thinking that, oh, like, you're ticked off at how polarized things are. What if there was something different? A question I asked Andrew Yang when he came on the podcast, and he did not give me a convincing answer. So I will this is not being a bad podcast. But instead of just giving a follow up, I'll just like whine about it a year later. I was like, Andrew, it's great to say that, like, you know, you don't like these binary choices, but who would you appoint to the Supreme Court if you were president?
Yeah.
Because the second he would have to make that choice, the Forward Party, obviously being like a center to center left institution, they'd pick what would almost certainly be a pro-choice nominee. Okay, then we're back where we started. You know, it's kind of like, I want to hear your guys' thoughts on this, because like, this is where I'm like, the Mugatu scene in Zoolander was like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. Okay, we're talking about supply, right? All American politics is, it's like a series of coalitions.
Right.
The fixed group, there's moderate tech bros, there's like Yimbies, there are NIMBYs, there are leftists, there are working class people, there are like LGBT people, all these different groups. If all we're doing is like adding another set of parties, it's still actually the same number of people. So you actually haven't increased like supply. So it'd be kind of interesting to say, like, what if we brought in like 100 million new immigrants who didn't have like the set of like biases, who didn't have like all these different things? You could just say this. I was like, that'd be a kind of an interesting experiment of adding new parties. But we have the same set of coalitions, and all we do is like throw in the titles. I'm like, wait, like, let's say the Yang coalition, let's say they get like a third of the vote. They take the tech bros, they take center people, they take the Country Club Republicans, they take the Biden Republicans, they take a Democrat who's like, I could never go for Bernie Sanders. The second you have a Supreme Court justice, where the only actual questions that matter are guns, and abortion. Oh, and by the way, like, the student loan thing's probably gonna go before the Supreme Court. So that's another example where that really matters. They're gonna end up caucusing with the Democrats. We're back right where we started. So like, I really, if I could give one thing for listeners, it's like, really think of these things as coalitions, and things would make a lot more sense.
Is that like a kind of like even super case of like Arrow's theorem, that it's like, because of the way our government is structured and the way we fight over things, like, we're just like eternally doomed to like kind of sort out into a bipolar kind of coalition sorting, like, not just because of the election system, but because eventually you're going to have to decide who you appoint to the Supreme Court. And then you're either with us or you're with them.
Great question. The thing I push back on is like the idea of like the way our government is structured, because that's just politics. Like, even like a fascist dictatorship has to make a choice. Like, Xi Jinping has to decide, like, hey, do we invade Taiwan or not? Do I go for my third term or not? Do I, like, what's the deal? Is the Chinese, should China have a zero COVID policy, or should we open up? Like, binary choices are inherent in governance. And too often, because I really like where your question is coming from, too often reformers do this kind of annoyingly like technocracy, if we could turn the dials to the right degree, we could fix everything, by saying, you know, if we didn't have first past the post elections, and if there were open primaries, and if there were more parties, it'd be different. Like, sometimes that could be true, but right now we're in a binary moment. And so much of what people are going to get over the next 3 or 4 years is the fact that during binary moments, it just sucks.
Right, right. So is it something where, like, yes, on the margin, like, maybe you do, like, approval voting and it's, like, more median candidates and come down the pike or something. But at the end of the day, like, all the applause lines and political speeches are, you know, getting the other side at some level, it feels like.
During a moment like this, yes. And, like, look, this is why I'm always, like, thinking about, like, book projects, like, way down the line. Yeah. Something I'm really interested in is just, like, as someone who's born in 1992, like, looking at the 1990s and treating the 1990s as, like, wow, there was this moment where, like, everything was kind of, and once again, it wasn't awesome, but there was a chance to forge a new consensus. There was approach to all these different, and we didn't take that for a variety of reasons, but basically, like, that is a period where there were opportunities to be, like, very positive and ability, not just have to go for the applause lines, right? Like,
gotcha.
Al Gore is, like, running on climate change and talking about reinventing government. And that was, like, a real project that he did, like, the information superhighway. Like, that just isn't one of these moments. And there's this, like, really just deeply, and I think we'll get to my role as, like, a podcaster later, but a very concerted decision I've made, and I'm blessed to be able to, like, make a good living this way is, like, look, I could get a lot of clicks telling you guys that this is, like, easy and straightforward and that you're one final victory away from defeat or from victory. Both true and untrue. I think if you're Blake Masters running in the Arizona GOP primary, the Arizona GOP Senate seat right now, and now the race is swinging around the abortion issue. That's actually an example of how a victory at the Supreme Court could actually lead to a defeat at a senatorial. He's down 10 points now.
I'm stealing one victory away from defeat from now on.
Yeah,
that's great.
That's the nature of these, like, high stakes moments. So, but it's basically just sort of like, look, guys, like, accept the fact this is difficult.
Yeah.
It's not easy. And this is what this just looks like. Like, you know, I'm sure, like, if you're sitting in 1892, I'm sure you're like, oh man, like, all these changes are afoot. There's all these big political issues. I don't really like the governing class. I'm not too hot and bothered about Grover Cleveland. If I told you, but guys, like it or not, in the, like, 1910s, there's going to be this progressive movement and all these changes are going to happen. That wouldn't sate anybody.
Exactly.
But it's also just the harsh truth. Like, the harsh truth is that if you're looking for big victories in the 2020s, like, you're not going to have a good time.
Exactly.
And what I think my goal as, like, a community builder, as a podcaster, is, like, how can I help people come to accord with the fact that the debate is, like, what do we do in the 2030s? And how do we make the 2020s just not, like, a loss? How do we, like, minimize the damage?
Yeah.
And then how do we actually enter into a period where we actually can do bigger things? Because I think that time is coming, but it's easy just to, like, remember all the takes were like, oh, like, COVID's gonna, we're gonna open up and we'll have, like, a new American, like, renaissance. And that didn't happen because that's just not what the 2020s were ever gonna be.
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, how everyone just, like, thought we were in this big moment where we're going to, like, change everything. We're going to reach this new consensus. We're going to come together. Just like we thought that after 9/11, too. And we came out of it more polarized than ever. And so I'm kind of wondering, you've talked about this a lot on your podcast, this notion of, like, vibes, right? How everything is just vibes. Like, nobody cares about policy. Everyone just cares about how you present and how badly you can bloody the nose of the other side, at least on the national level. Like, is there any hope of escape from just the rule of vibes in the 2020s? Is that the mist we're trying to just, like, fight through?
So I would push back and say, actually, I think people care about policy, like, a lot. Yeah. Like, for example, like, President Biden's poll decline started during, like, like, regardless of what your position is on, like, whether we should have stayed in Afghanistan or not, like, I think the terrible way the withdrawal was implemented, like, that significantly affected polling. Decisions like how you handle the Ukraine war, like, people, I generally think people care about policy. When I talk about vibes, I'm basically, and it's ephemeral by definition, but when I talk about vibes, I'm really talking about the ability to just, like, read the room and actually perceive, like, where politics are. There's this, like, fun German word, which I found was just, like, the Schwerpunkt. And it means, like, it's, like, in a battle, it's, like, the center point. I was reading this book about Napoleon, and basically the point was, like, Napoleon could, like, always find the Schwerpunkt in the battle. There's this huge battle, there's these huge armies, but there's, like, this really, like, this point. So when I talk about vibes to me means, like, if a politician is good at this, a politician could pick up, like, okay, like, oh, wow, like, the country's, like, not really feeling it right now. And how do I speak to that? How does this change the way I perform? And I think it's kind of funny. Like, I think a politician who's done a great job of this is like John Fetterman, like whether or not he wins. And this isn't exact, like this isn't a science, but look, Oz's vibes are just off.
Yeah.
Oz is very clearly a dude who was like, hey, like I'm a smart guy. He is a smart guy. I'm a smart, like accomplished guy. I'm telegenic. I'm good at TV. Look at what Trump did. I could do that.
Yeah.
And what Fetterman just very accurately assessed, whether it's his team or him, is like, yeah, this, it's just off. This dude just isn't from here. Like it's like this dude was just sort of like, you know what? I'm just going to like move to PA.
Yeah.
Like I'm not really from here, but like I can pull it off. I'm just going to do it. And he is just calling it out. That's an example of just like reading the vibe. Like he's not like Fetterman isn't making this right about like universal healthcare and like policy. Cause like that isn't the vibe of that campaign is not. The vibe actually isn't about policy. In that case, there's just something like broader he's picking up on. And I think that like in an ideal world, you'd have a combination of like policy. Like we had a Q&A from a listener where they're like, do you think Fetterman's going to be a good thing for American politics? Whether you're left, right, or center, I don't think John Fetterman's going to change anything like personally. Because like what he's doing, he's got the vibe down, but I don't find him particularly impressive as like a – I think he's going to be like a – once again, this is fine. He's going to be a generic, like left of center, a bit left of center Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be his thing. He's going to vote. He doesn't have anything. I don't think he has anything particularly useful to add. I will say, I think his like mode of dress is probably like a really bad thing. Cause this is also something that I talk about a lot. Like,
yeah.
This is a real point of frustration for the audience. So like, there's a lot of like populist people listen. A lot of people who are populists who like listen to the show and they're like, Marshall Sager, like, why are you guys mad at John Fetterman for like wearing shorts and sweatshirts? And why do you get mad when you have a picture of a GOP senator with like flip-flops and shorts, like walking around Congress? People are like, all I care about is I want people who do the right thing. I don't care what they look like. And the real conundrum here, two things. One, we've kind of run this experiment. Think about it. Like we've had declining dress standards since the 1960s. Has that produced better policy? Like, it's at a very basic level. It's like, wait, so we've tried your experiment, right? Like, we don't dress like Don Draper anymore. Like, we don't have evening dress. I'm not saying that was like a good thing. I'd say that's definitely like way too far. Like, we don't want to be like the man in the gray flannel suit. I should not be like, if I ran a company, I would not have people like, if the realignment was like bigger and in person, I would not say like, you guys better wear your suits because if you don't have a pocket square, you're disrespectful. Like, that's not my vibe. But my point is, we've experimented with decreasing dress standards. And we haven't gotten better policy. All we've actually gotten is a real lack of respect for institutions. Because for me, and maybe this comes from like being in a fraternity and like being sort of like institutionally focused, the reason why John Fetterman is supposed to wear a suit is because John Fetterman, when he's in the Senate, shouldn't matter. If you are a senator, you are ultimately one of 100 people in this institution which represents something bigger than yourself. So right. Guess what? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you, John Fetterman, want to do. It matters that you're in this institution, and in this institution, there are rules, and you follow the rules. In a weird way, I'm realizing I'd probably be fine if they all had matching tracksuits. It's something that where it's just like, you do not matter, because what people should really understand is that a lot of the time when they see politicians like dressing down and not like institutionally like queuing to rules, they read it as, oh, they're like, you know, cool. None of these people are cool or casual. Because it's like this, it's the same people. Like a person who's running for office now is the type of person who would have run for office in the 1960s. So it's the same personality type. Obviously, like arrogance and narcissism are probably like required to operate in the federal level. So I'm not just giving cheap shots, but it's the same personality. They are just doing it in a disrespectful manner. They are actually just saying, like, you know what? Like, I actually just don't feel like dressing up. So I'm just like not going to do it.
Yeah.
So you're not getting better policy. They're being kind of cynical. And it's just sort of bad. So what I will really end with here with is like, I advocate for just uniformity of dress. But even if everyone gave the Zuckerberg out, if everyone showed up with the Zuckerberg, like Everlane t-shirt of jeans and like New Balances, I'd kind of be okay with that because it would represent subliminating your narcissism to the institution and to the actual role that you have.
Right. Gotcha. Yeah. That's interesting.
It seems like this is like a super underrated a point. Like at some level, it feels like, you know, we have this crazy polarization within the last 20 some odd years. I guess, you know, maybe it starts with Newt Gingrich. Maybe it's been going since the 70s. I'm not exactly sure. But how much do you think it is the fact that people and politicians have at some level gotten more individualistic, or does that not matter at all?
No, it's a good question. Two parts to that. So one, yeah, that plays a huge role in it because under previous systems, like the party had just total power. Yeah. This is where I get really annoyed when, you know, people like Andrew Yang talk about how, oh, like the parties, they're so powerful. It's like, A, the Republican Party didn't have a platform in 2020. Like straight up at the convention. They did not vote on a party platform because what everyone understands now is the party doesn't actually matter. I kind of think of parties as like a record label. Like the party is just like, hey, like I'm like moderate. So like I'm a Texas Democrat. That says something about me.
Right, right.
Oh, hey, like I'm in Oregon. We're like the status quo. So I'm an Oregon Republican.
Yeah.
That's just a party label. In the past, there was literally a smoke-filled room where they said, like literally, these are the rules.
Here's what you're going to do.
These are these bits that are happening. And look, it definitely like went too far. It was something kind of crazy, but I just recently learned is like, think of like the 1968 presidential campaign, like RFK wins all these primaries. He's assassinated. But even if he'd won those primaries, it was technically possible the Democratic Party bosses would have not actually given him the nomination, would have given it to Hubert Humphrey, the sitting vice president. Now, it ended up, you know, happening because like the assassination, but that could have ended up happening. That was not a good world. But if we think of these extremes, we've swung too far to the other extreme where now every single individual politician is incentivized to ignore the institution, ignore the coalition, ignore the teams that do whatever they want. So this is really why I really think folks who like are dissatisfied with the status quo should really ask themselves deep questions about this moment, which is that like, how has John Fetterman and people like him thinking, but I'm here for whatever I want. And let's be good faith, because I think John Fetterman seems like a nice enough guy.
Yeah.
I'm here to interpret whatever I think the people, broadly speaking, want.
Gotcha.
It's just too far, because the incentives just really stack up. So to the point of polarization, that's a situation where as the party has lost control and everyone can do whatever they want, and during an era of like low institutional and like low trust, it's created an incentive for politicians basically just go hog wild and do whatever they want. And to be like a boomer for a second, if you go back to the founding fathers, they would say like, that's not a good thing. Like it's actually like not a good thing for a senator to think like, hey, like I can just do whatever the heck I want.
Right.
Because like I'm judging it to be the right thing, because like something I'm really interested in too, and this is also why I push back on people who argue we need to have fundamental reforms of the system. I think we're at late stage folks who just grew up in the old world. If you are a senator now, even if you're like a Gen X, like late stage millennial, like you just grew up with like the 1990s and the 2000s, like as your actual model, you don't know how to operate in a space like we have today. So like they just have like, it's just a disaster, like bad incentives, like the wrong actors. And one other quick thing I'll add too, because I know this people are probably thinking about this. This is, however, also why to go back to our earlier conversation, why I think folks should really think about the whole idea of like DC being toxic. This is also why we shouldn't think just electing more young people inherently like actually like fixes it. Because like when we elect young people, we just go into the system and they just like replicate the badness of like this system on all those like different levels. So that's why I think like someone who I'd be really interested in politically is like, let's say there's like a tech founder who is in like some like American dynamism space. Actually, no. Like, let's think of like Ryan Peterson from Flexport. I would be interested in how someone like him responded to the political system, because Ryan is deeply aware of like supply chains. That's actually an issue. It's like very up for grabs. Like he can really build things. He's very fluent. He's very talented. I'd be interested in how someone like him like behaves in a political system 10 years from now. So what would happen if he were senator from California? Now, that being said, I think if he were to get elected now, it wouldn't lead to anything, because he'd be entering into the toxic system. But like, that's my point about the 2030s. I would demand fundamental reform of the system, as if I could demand things. If in the 2030s, when you have time to work these things through, when you do have the world change, if we still can't do things then, I'm like, okay, that's kind of the thing.
Yeah. So one of the things that really strikes me about that is that you've got this kind of like seizure of the standard means of control. And it kind of rhymes a little bit with me with like other places we've seen those disruptions, you know, with like standardization of media or whatever. It's like you guys are busy disrupting right now with podcasting and things like that. And it feels like right now, like, you've got institutional DC, you've got this gerontocracy, right? And then you feed young, ambitious people like AOC into it, and then they start coming out kind of like standard issue Democrats or whatever. You can push back on that if you disagree with it. But like there's this notion of like you've made this case that like DC is just this machine that like turns people into people who perpetuate the ineffectiveness of the system. One thing that I've noticed is everyone I talk to, they care about such a different set of, like when I said vibes before and you push back on, I actually agree with your pushback because people do care about policy, but the kind of policies like, I mean, people care about abortion, they care about CRT, but they also care about all these other issues that like don't really get play at the federal level. You know what I mean? Like, it's really interesting to me, like on the federal level where like Biden can't decide if home prices going up is good or bad. You know, when you like see them like talk about this, it's like, you know, and all kinds of other issues like with student loans, I guess, is something that is in play right now, you know, but it feels like, you know, in the UK, they're debating like the cost of living crisis and all these things. I feel like there's all these issues that don't get play that are more like and you're talking about like the Flexport CEO. You know, I wonder if in the 2030s, we can have this more of a sewer socialist and whatever the conservative equivalent of that kind of movement of a get things done and solve actual problems for people movement looks like. And how do we get there?
Yeah, so a couple of things to that. So number one, I would say that I wouldn't actually describe DC as a gerontocracy because, as you even stated, there are plenty of young people who are elected. Like last night, a Gen Zer won a Democratic primary in a very strong blue seat, so we're probably going to have our first Gen Z member of Congress. So it's not that the issue is just all these old people. And like, funnily enough, like, I think that Joe Biden was more in touch with the country than like Pete Buttigieg or Kamala Harris were. Debate how Biden has performed, but Biden, I've really pushed people on this. November 2020, Joe Biden, as a very old man, had an accurate read on where the country was. Yeah. And the Schwerpunkt of that moment relative to his much younger competition. Yeah. So pushback or gerontocracy. Here's the actual issue in DC. I think the issue in DC is no one basically knows what they're doing.
That's not good.
In the sense that, like, so for example, like, let's talk about AOC for a second. Because I actually really don't like when, you know, like super like leftists are like, oh, look at AOC. Like, she's just like a total sellout. She's kowtowing to Nancy Pelosi, all these different bits. Like, look, like, the actual thing is like, what exactly is like AOC supposed to do?
Like, the system just won't let her do what she wants?
No, it's she doesn't know how to do what she wants in the system. So for example, so here's an example of this. Like, and this is like, if I get to sit down with AOC, I would genuinely ask her this question. She is fascinating to me because on one level, she's very eloquent. She's very talented at social media. But she has this terrible habit of polarizing herself for like no good reason. So Green New Deal, already a very polarizing thing. Why then is she deciding to get in fights about Latinx usage?
Yeah.
I did an episode on this that will probably come out by the time like this is out. And look, like I would never like use the term Latinx. I would say Latino, Latina. Like I'm a fluent Spanish speaker, so I just wouldn't do that. But at the same time, I get why someone would say Latinx.
Yeah.
So just shut up. Like, why would you, if the issue right now is that any issue that's touched instantly becomes toxically polarized.
Yeah.
If you're already touching, let's say the Green New Deal, why would you also become known as a person who's getting in polarizing fights about Latinx? Why are you deciding that it's a good idea to get in Twitter fights with Ted Cruz? Yeah. Because like what's going to happen is with those two issues, Ted Cruz fights and Latinx, they invariably are going to infect your position on Green New Deal.
Yes.
It invariably is going to affect your position on the on student loans, like another incredibly polarized issue. So my point is, it's not the system that's breaking AOC. Like Biden just passed probably like the strongest like climate legislation we're going to get in a while. She's getting no credit for that. And that's because she fundamentally did not operate properly. And I think from a playbook perspective, and this is why like I think there are a lot of people who just like are keeping their heads down right now, as I think they should be. People are going to learn like, okay, interesting. You have to make choices. This is what Glenn Youngkin knows.
Yeah.
And that Charlie Baker doesn't know, or maybe it's not up for grabs for him.
Yeah.
They see the governorship. Glenn Youngkin wants to be president. Yes. Charlie Baker knows his best bet is Health and Human Services HHS secretary. But if you are a smart, like kind of leftist person, you're thinking like, okay, I am going to have to make a tough choice on the Green New Deal.
Yes.
I'm not going to get into Twitter beef with Ted Cruz.
Right.
And I should also think to myself, yes, I get a huge like Instagram following, but like to what end? Like this is always like my favorite. Like this is my favorite thing. This is what we're seeing develop. Like there's this obsession with saying like, oh, like these millennials and AOC, they know how to use like Instagram. But I'm like, okay, but like to what use was it?
Yeah.
Well, like, think about it. Did AOC's mastery of Instagram get the Green New Deal passed? Did it make her the centerpiece for climate legislation?
Right.
Is she better set up to win the New York primary if she ever primaried Chuck Schumer? The answer is no. So during this period of figuring it out, people are going to be, people are going to sort.
Right.
And that's basically like my point. So like, I don't think there's anything, so to close it, like, I don't think there's anything systemic that's breaking AOC. I think she and her team are having to make tough choices where a lot of the time they're wrong.
Okay. So, like, back to the point then. So that covers AOC specifically, but like to the more general point of like whatever the DC machine is doing and what it optimizes for, it seems like it's not serving not just the method of not getting things done, but also like these other issues it feels like that a lot of people care about that don't necessarily get play because they're either not, they don't have high culture war valence, or they're not the kind of things that the people in the institutional fights are caring about right now, you know? And so, how do we get them to care about them in the next 10 years?
And this is, okay, so this is helpful. Like, frankly, this is kind of the way that's done. So like, no, seriously, like the thing that's interesting, if you look at like young politicians are able to like notice things. Like I'm really interested, like I read a lot of like political biographies and I'm like really interested in like, what do people not in power think? What do people who are going to be in power? A good example is the following. Remember during the height of the supply chain crisis, when you know, Ryan Peterson is out in the boat in the LA harbor, like literally like live tweeting problems, and it actually leads to some big
people
changes.
Food and doing these kinds of stuff.
I've asked this to so many people. I'm like, why wasn't Pete Buttigieg on the boat with him?
It's a great question.
Right? Like, do you realize how much of a win that would have been?
Yeah.
And you could say to yourself, like, well, you know, that infrastructure, it's not like a sexy issue, but like, but this is where vibes come in.
Right.
If Pete Buttigieg should have been on a boat with Ryan Peterson saying,
yes,
hey guys, Christmas, the holiday season is in danger.
Yes.
Let's save Christmas.
Let's save Christmas. Haven't you guys all basically noticed to the start of this episode that America doesn't seem to work that well anymore?
Exactly.
Well, I, Pete Buttigieg, because he's a self-interested politician, I'm working with my good buddy Ryan to dynamically fix this problem. And the Biden administration is going to fix this problem.
Yeah.
That is what political talent is. So, and because I've asked a bunch of friends of mine, like I've asked, like, for example, like friends of mine who are like state reps.
Yeah.
They don't know who Ryan Peterson is. They don't really know the supply chain issue.
Yeah.
Because this current set of people whose approach to politics was formed in the 1990s through the 2010s, they are not good at what politics actually is. And I think if Pete Buttigieg were as impressive as people say he is, he would have been on that boat.
Yes.
Because I'm just sort of like, how are you missing this? But the answer is he's missing this because he's too stuck in the current system.
So you're saying it's not that he decided not to get on the boat. He wasn't aware that he should be on the boat, and he wasn't aware that there was a boat.
Exactly. Like that's actually exactly it. Like, and this is something that Catherine Boyle and I talked about. Like, she was saying the thing of reason she's optimistic about American politics. People like wrote in about this point. She's like, I hate tech propaganda. I hate even the founder conversation gets a little like awkward sometimes.
Yes.
To be entirely honest. But I think this is entirely a good faith truth point. She's like, at a core level, like being a founder, like selects for certain skill sets.
Yes.
You are addressing problems. You're attacking them with aggression. You own things. You're accountable. Like that's the deal.
Yes.
That if you are smart, you are a politician listening to Catherine Boyle saying that.
Yes.
And putting that into your system for what I should actually be taking on.
Yeah.
So if you're, once again, and this is like the funny take, like, and this is what I'm still wondering about AOC, but I think that she's the way that the media talks about this point, because we're talking about media right here. What I love is like, I did this interview with two New York Magazine reporters who wrote a book about AOC, and they made the statement that, quote, student loan debt is like the issue of the millennial generation. And once again, this isn't about debating like the policy approach. Like, I don't think that's true. Like, I actually think that if you even like, most millennials don't even go to college.
Yeah.
So they don't even have debt.
Yeah.
Or if they do have it, it's like not as high. Like that is an example of like missing where like the strength point or missing where the center of gravity is.
Yeah.
The center of gravity in American politics post COVID in September 2021 was, holy crap, everything is so broken.
Yes.
That needs to be fixed. And I hope that politicians and wannabe politicians are noticing that
right.
and saying, okay, we'll do that. And another thing, and this is also something that I really just like wonder about, like, and I think that this is kind of like an example of how the polarizations that we fought back against. I'm fascinated by all these politicians who like just very clearly like wake up like every single day
yeah.
and are like, let's polarize things like even more. right. So like,
let's do it.
There's like,
let's just double down and make everyone mad.
Yeah. This is the funny. So like Marjorie Taylor Greene or like Lauren Boebert, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm picking on the right here, but I think they're two very prominent examples of this.
Yeah.
And I think there are structural reasons why this tends to be more of a right issue than a left issue. Yeah. Like ultimately because the right is like anti-government, like it incentivizes, like Democrats have their own problems, but this is their version of this. I've never understood why someone just doesn't turn to like Lauren Boebert. It's like, dude, like, Can you just stop?
Yeah, can you just stop?
Look, the country like sucks right now.
Yeah.
Everyone feels like the country sucks right now. I don't get the sense that you're waking up every day and trying to fix those things.
Exactly.
You're basically saying to yourself, like, hey, how do I get more retweets by making a certain group of people more pissed off? Like that is literally all they are doing.
Yeah.
And I don't understand. And this is why, like, my dream Pete Buttigieg.
yes.
Right. If I were like Liz Smith and advising, I'd say, like, dude, like what you should be doing right now is be on that boat with Ryan Peterson.
Yep.
And then when Lauren Boebert is annoying, say, dude, can you just not?
Yes.
I'm here fixing stuff.
Yes.
Everyone's exhausted by this. Like I kind of call this, I told this to my like fiance. I was like, it's kind of like muscular normism. It's kind of like the whole like, why can't we get along like the Washington of old? It's not like that lame, like kind of like,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, David McCullough just like passed away and I think he's a great biographer, but it speaks to this very like, Tom Brokaw, the greatest. It's like, it's taking that notion, but putting it like muscularly. It's like, why would anyone want any of these people to be in charge of anything?
Exactly.
These polarizers, like these, like that's all they are doing. Yep. It's like, dude, just start your podcast.
Exactly. Right? And then just don't bother take anybody.
Public funds to grow your Twitter brand.
Exactly.
Me and my, and this could happen left or right, right? Yeah, there could be like a right of center version of response. Like, cause like, Kevin McCarthy, they don't like MJT either. So it's just sort of like, why can't you just say, if you're a successful American politician today, like my coalition is this country's broken, we're gonna fix it. If you're not, like, we could have different solutions to the way that things are fixed. Exactly. But if you're not on the train, like get the F off.
Right.
But I think that is what like that is what the basic point would be. Like because think about this. Like think of the world we like grew up in. Like if you told 1990s us, like age yourself up. You know, there's gonna be a world where with like all the wonders of Amazon and all those things, it might be possible that like you might not get goods that you ordered for Christmas.
Yeah.
Like I ordered furniture. It takes months to get things. Like that is like, that's crazy. Like that's actually, like, if you actually sit down and think about that for a second, like that's insane.
Messed up.
Our political project should be making that like not a thing.
Exactly.
And anyone who isn't on board that, go off to the side. So that's my real, like, I genuinely have not had a convincing, and this is why I love being in tech because I think tech gets this, but there, and that's the whole, like, oh, like there's a gap between tech and what it's a cliche. I think it's like not that helpful, but the weird world we're in right now is that, oh, actually this is helpful. The weird world we're in right now is tech is living in this future.
Yeah.
And I think it's very on it on a couple of different things. Tech is talking about supply chains. Tech is talking about dynamism. Things don't work. Tech is good on China. Tech was right on COVID at the start. But they're also terrible at living in the present world.
Right.
So I'm sure you guys may have noticed this on Twitter, but there are all these like tech founder VC types for the past year have been like tweeting out some of the most like right-wing, red pill stuff. And then the Dobbs decision comes out, like overturned Roe v. Wade. And then they're like, oh my gosh, what happened?
Pull the brakes.
And I'm like, are you serious?
Yes.
Like, there was just announced that, you know, David Sachs and Keith Raboy are hosting like a major like fundraiser for Republicans in Miami. People are like, what?
Oh my gosh, like, they're doing it. Like, yeah, duh. Like,
what do you think the red pill thing was? And I'm not saying like, because once again, like abortion is like a serious, like weighty issue.
Yes.
But that's like my frustration with tech, where it's like you were so focused on the fact that, like, once again, like I think Keith and David are great at talking about like what are these like IRL problems in America right now that techs need to do a better job on.
Exactly.
But people in tech also aren't good at saying, like, okay, cool, like, but what do they think about like the current issues? like right. of today. Yeah. So I think my dream world would be a world where like you could merge like tech's ability to diagnose specific problems in America. Because I think tech and venture are good at giving you this skill set, but too often tech looks at this current system, the gerontocracy, whatever, and basically treats it like legacy hardware and wants to just like wish it away.
Right.
And like wish, this is their version of the Andrew Yang trap where they're like, man, like these parties suck. And they just like wish them away. And basically just like, just think about it. Right? If you're pitching a VC, you would not do it that way. Yeah. But that's not actually an optimal way for navigating a system.
Well, it's like crypto, like grappling with regulation coming down the pipe hard and fast, you know, but that'll take us off topic real quick. So one thing I want to talk about that I think segues into this pretty well is this notion of cost disease socialism. And when I say that, this for the audience sake, I'm not necessarily like trying to like make a capitalism socialism point. It's a very specific phenomenon. And this ties into student loan, the student loan debate and things. And so like, I believe cost disease socialism specifically applies to when you restrict supply of something, but also subsidize it. And Econ 101 tells you that sends the price right up. And so like Noah Smith's talked about it. I don't think he invented the term, but he like has written about it. And so this is basically like a kind of like, it's alleged that this is like a worst of all policy intervention because you don't get any more of the stuff. Like the goal is to get abundance, but instead we just make the price higher. And I think that's basically Sagar's entire point on your pod on breaking points, and maybe he's brought it up on the realignment. I was wondering what your thoughts on the theory of cost disease socialism are, and also specifically about whether that's actually what's happening now with certain of our policies in medicine and housing and higher education and things like that, like all these issues that like people really care about.
No, I think that's a great way to put it. I'd say, you know, focusing on higher ed specifically, that's the issue I'm most focused on. I think it fits with conversation we were having earlier about like issues and like addressing things. You see the cost disease socialism thing happening in the sense that like all we seem to know how to do is subsidize things.
Right.
So all we know how to do, looking at the higher ed system, which everyone agrees like doesn't work or isn't optimized. All we know how to do, we only know how to do two things. Oh, sorry. We know how to subsidize things. We also know how to unhelpfully unsubsidize things. So like, for example, an example of the unhelpful is like after, you know, the 2008 financial crisis, like states like severely cut aid to public universities, which like obviously like led to putting that on students and athletics and other different things. And like, we could obviously have a debate in our society, like what is a public good? Like what should the university system look like? Like the University of California was not only super cheap because like inflation was lower of education costs, but because the state of California was like, oh no, like we think it is a good thing for our state to do that.
Yeah.
You could take a different perspective on that thing, but that's what like the unhelpful version is.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to subsidized, so that, I think that's the Republican version of this. Yeah. The Republican version is higher ed sucks. So like, let's just like, unhelpfully cut funding.
Exactly.
Without like tying that to something specific.
Oh, exactly.
Then the Democratic version of this, or like the left version, this is where the socialism comes in, honestly, is okay, so we see this cost is really high. We see people have all these problems. Let's subsidize via increasing Pell Grants. Right. And this is one of those big disasters where like we increase the size of the Pell Grant. A Pell Grant is like aid for people who like need it.
Right.
But then like the inflation of costs over a 10-year period, like literally ate up the amount of like the increase. So then we're just stuck again. Maybe you get help the first year, but then we're back again. Or by blanket student loan forgiveness or just by like overly generous like loan policies.
Yeah.
So in my version of America, and I think this is what is going to be selected for.
Gotcha.
Because this is because once again, what's funny is I can have this conversation with anybody who's not captive to the incentives of like the status quo, where you would say to yourself, like, look, the issue right now isn't really like, do we like extend the student loan pause? The actual issue is that our higher education system is like super broken. And part of what may get us out of that would be, okay, let's make sure that we reform the system. And then we should probably like forgive loans to people who got screwed by the previous system. So this is one of my favorite, because I think student loans are just like the most fascinating topic ever. It's so interesting because let's think about this like rhetorical bit that people just sort of take, which is basically like, we shouldn't be, you know, we shouldn't let people take out loans for like underwater basket weaving or like always sigh. And like the government just says, we'll give you a loan for anything. You just do it. Yeah. But dig beneath that for a second. And I talked about this on today's episode of The Realignment. What operationally happens is we get into a society where only upper middle class kids like me could get poli-sci degrees.
Right.
And if we actually talk this out, we actually don't want to live in an America where if you're lower middle class or poor or working class or middle class, you have to get like a STEM degree, and all like the artsy fartsy liberal arts degrees are for people like me. That's what you operationally are saying when you're saying we shouldn't just subsidize our underwater basket weaving. So a way to have that conversation is, okay, should states furnish more funds for education? That's the way you could do it. You could say like, hey, like in Oregon, because I'm at the University of Oregon, we don't want to live in a state where only rich kids get to do fun degrees. I don't want to say fun, okay? Like we don't want to live in a state where like STEM, it also happens when people talk about apprenticeships. Yeah. Like my number one like point of frustration is when like, and I'm sorry, this is a polarizing word, but I would say it, when privileged people like me say, why don't we have enough apprenticeships? And it's like, I'm gonna be honest, like my kids are probably not gonna have apprenticeships.
Right.
Like they're not gonna do it. And I'd be honest if I was like, man, like, come on, dude. Like I was gonna be, the podcast money would have gone to, why don't you go full ride? Like, why?
Yeah, you need to put in 40 hours of podcasting before you can become a journeyman podcaster. And
that's the take there. So it's like, that's the underlying system. Like we could talk about like, what do we want to actually look like? And then forgiveness, the degree for subsidize could be the end point of that, because people are going to get, someone's going to get hurt, someone's going to suffer. And that's once again what coalition of politics looks like. So like the system, once again, this is why we're talking about, what are we selecting for? What sucks about right now is we are selecting for people who either do nothing, which is basically, if you're a Republican in Congress, you're interested in like just dunking on higher ed and how it sucks. Or you're saying unhelpful things like, what's like, I hate this talking point too, where you're like, the endowments are so big, let's take the endowment money. Because A, like, to talk about this point, when people talk about big endowments, they're talking about like Harvard, all the things that are LPs. A, like, Harvard actually spends like a decent amount of money on students. Like, yeah. If your family makes less than 80K, you will probably go to Harvard or Yale for very little money. Yeah. Because it's subsidized by the endowment. Like Harvard and Yale are not the cost of like, are not the cause of what we're going through right now. And I also think it's so funny that like on the one hand, like Republicans who are anti one-time wealth taxes on Jeff Bezos, because they would be unfair, which that would be just unfair to say like, you know what? Like, I'm just going to wake up and be like, you know what? Like, we're just going to take your money like after the fact. This is the same exact principle. And it's just bad. And it's also wouldn't, it'd be a one-time tax. So right. Wouldn't something, but then the left version of this to your point is, okay, we know this thing is too expensive. Yeah. Let's give people it without doing it. So I want a politics where we like start from, wait, this doesn't work.
Yes.
Let's work to make it work. And part of what makes it work is, how do we deal with people who are screwed by the previous system?
So here's an interesting thought. So like, one of the pills I've taken recently is the Norwegian resource management pill. So I'm a Norwegian citizen, so I'm a little biased here because I'm standing for the home team. But I read this research article this year, which like really opened my eyes, because like Norway has this famous sovereign wealth fund in oil. And I read recently about it, and what surprised me is that it was not set up by Norwegians, or not entirely. The person who spearheaded it was he's a Norwegian now. He's an Iraqi immigrant. And he was just ditzing around for a petroleum job. He's like, you guys need any petroleum engineers? He's like, we just discovered an F ton of oil. We have no local industry. What should we do with it? And he's like, I've seen this before. I've seen the resource curse. And he had this really interesting insight. And apparently the Norwegians who set up the hydropower management industry 50 years earlier had the same insight. And so they both had the same solution. And it really dovetails with cost disease socialism, which is this notion that when you artificially restrict access to a resource, either through it's just naturally restricted because it's scarce, or it's artificially restricted through politics. A good example in America would be my narcolepsy medicine. It's a simultaneously Schedule 1, Schedule 3 drug, so the government in its wisdom has granted a monopoly to one company. So when you create those artificial restrictions or natural restrictions, you get what we call a resource rent, a overabundant super profit, because nobody can naturally compete with you, or competition is constrained. And Norway's solution to this is not like American socialists like love to talk to me about Norway all the time and how it's perfect, knowing very little actually about Norway. And so Norway's solution is to tax the resource rent at like a really punitive level, because it's basically just an ongoing windfall profit, but leave a normal amount of profit if you were actually a working for a living company. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, you have the Brian Kaplans of the universe that come in and is like, well, this is going to discourage innovation and research and exploration, you know, because like the companies are going to whine that it's like, oh, there's so much R&D and it's so expensive. And so the Norwegians will subsidize the R&D and the exploration of oil, but they will tax like punitively the oil that comes out of the pipe. Because so that you don't have people just like sitting on the wells. And, you know, and this is me just giving you Norwegian propaganda here, is that it seems like over the past 50 years, it's really worked. It seems like in a kind of industrial management policy that can kind of be abstracted away to other issues of scarcity, that like instead of subsidizing the wrong thing and taxing the wrong thing, you tax the right thing and you subsidize the right thing, and you can kind of actually get abundance and competence and not set the ocean on fire like other national oil companies sometimes do. I was wondering if you'd heard this approach before, or what you think of it. You know, I mean, feel free to push back and tell me it's nonsense. You know, it's just like taken over my mind lately.
Yeah, I've never heard of it. I think it's an interesting idea. What I think about when I hear something like this is just like my immediate reaction is just sort of like, man, like it's not useful, unhelpfully comparing countries to one another. Mm-hmm. Because you just gave this whole like complicated history of how I could have this thing, and it's like very unproductive just to look at Norway and say, oh wow, we should be like that. You kind of see this in like the gun debate. But when it comes to, my number to take away would just basically be like this idea of like subsidizing the right things. So subsidizing research, resources, those different bits. I also just struggle with the fact that it doesn't seem like we're going to have in subsequent decades the equivalent of we discover oil.
Right.
And that's like the interesting question. And the other interesting question too is if we did, would we have the foresight to go the Norwegian direction, or would just status quo happen? Well, so like, for example, like why does, maybe you don't know this, but like, and I don't know that either. Like why does like Alaska give like Alaskans like a portion of like the oil profits,
right?
Versus like maybe like Texas or other resource rich places. So I'm like,
we do have it's a tiny crappy version of the Alaska one. I think it like funds teachers and stuff. It like is actually like paid out of our
own. So you mean Texans?
Yeah.
Just got here, so I have no idea.
Yeah. Texas has like a crappy miniature version of like the Alaska fund. Like some of our oil dollars like goes to pay some teacher systems. I don't know a lot about it. All I know is it exists and it's not as good as Alaska's.
Yeah. So that's the real question is like, how does a society respond to like opportunity and abundance? And I think the pessimistic take is, I don't see this as being a moment where we would respond to the great hydrocarbon boom in quite the same way.
Right. Marshall, one more question here. What do the next 50 years look like for you? And how do you see your role in American politics evolving over time?
So it's funny. I usually talk about this in private, but I was just like,
well, we got it too.
I'll articulate it in terms of politics. So listeners, and to your podcast and to my podcast, will notice that like I'm very like bitter and annoyed towards politicians, and that's because of the fact that like I'm like a reformed politician kid.
Gotcha.
So what I mean by that is like this is so cringe. My email address in high school was kozloff2020@yahoo.com.
Nice.
Obviously I was going to run for Congress back in Oregon in 2020.
Yeah.
And I genuinely, you know, a couple of things happened over the 2010s, which made me like not want to do that.
Yeah.
So I look at these conversations and these people through the lens of like, oh, well, like I wanted to be them.
Right.
I wanted to say like, how would 2020, what Congressman Marshall like respond to these things? So what really happened, and this was like a really just like humbling moment, is I woke up one day and I was like, oh wow, like if you were a congressman, you would probably not be doing any of a better job than AOC. Because if I were a congressman, and this is leading to your question, if I were a congressman, it would have meant that I would have stayed in Oregon rather than going to DC, most likely. I would have stayed like in like Lake Oswego or like the Portland metro area. I would have like worked for a state legislator. Exactly. I would have like worked my way up like the greasy pole, get elected, and then do these different things. Yeah. But the thing is, I would just be a useless politician. Because think about what I think my actual useful insights are, like the supply chain issue stuff, the China stuff, the defense stuff, the tech stuff. I wouldn't have experienced any of these things.
Right.
I would have just been once again, not captive to the system or like the Democratic Party, but to the incentives or to the like unmolded models.
Right.
So I now think of myself as like, okay, so like you're someone who could look at this environment as like a reformed politician type, which gives you unique insight. Cause I think too, like it actually kind of frustrates me when you see, it's kind of funny because when I'm talking to people who are talking about like reform and why it doesn't happen, I'm like, too often outsider populist, like decentralized critics, they just don't get it because they're not those types of people.
Yeah.
So like I always get in this huge fight with like mostly like kind of like leftists about like money and politics.
Right.
So like I was talking to Kyle Kalinske, who's like Crystal Ball, Sagar's co-host, also fiance. So these things stack. it's not just CNN that has nepotism issues. Side note. But we were talking and Kyle was talking about, he was saying, quote, you know, like the only reason why Republicans like don't favor universal health care is because healthcare lobby is giving them money under the table.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, that's just like not true. And here's the way to run this experiment. The way to run this experiment is if you went to Madison Cawthorn and were like, hey, Madison Cawthorn,
guess what?
I'm going to give you like a donation if you were to come out in favor of universal healthcare. Yeah. Or hey, you go to, let's say like Josh Hawley, say, hey, Josh Hawley, you're very like pro First Amendment. The Bloomberg lobby is going to give you a bunch of money and because look, once again, as a politician type, I actually know how politician types think.
Yeah.
If you are in this political game, obviously there's the side conversation about like stocks and buybacks and those bits. Yes. But politicians, the more polarizing the issue, the less likely they are to actually think about money.
Right.
The funny take here is that the more to the side an issue is, the more likely there is to be a corruption issue.
Got it.
So like, let's say it's like a weird like pharmaceutical bill carve out.
As a torque regulation kind of thing.
That's an interesting conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd be curious like where that senator or congressperson's chief of staff goes after that bill passes.
Right.
I'd be very interested if that person became a lobbyist afterwards.
Yes, yes.
But when it comes to the polarizing issues, money does not dictate it. Gotcha. But genuinely.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to do as a podcaster is I want people to learn and understand that so that they could see the system as it actually is and understand the actual problem.
Think it is.
Michael Bloomberg could spend $10 billion and it would not convince a single Republican member to say, you know what? I actually think there are too many guns in this country.
Yeah.
Because once again, they're not responding to money. They're responding to actual opinions that actual people hold in those different bits. So speaking to my role then, I just want to keep talking to people.
Nice.
I think it's like super cool that, you know, we could like meet each other like on Twitter and just talk and this will get out there. And I'm just not, I had to make a decision. It's kind of funny. I have this experience a couple of times where I could be, this is going to sound very arrogant, but I'll plow it. We're deep, so I'll plow ahead.
It's a podcast.
I could be much bigger than I am very quickly. And by that, I mean, I know what episodes do super well.
Leaning into the culture war? Like,
no, not even that. It's not even culture war. It's just like a certain style of podcast. Like,
if you just wanted to min-max it, you know, just
just like min-max it.
Gotcha.
I was just sort of like, look, I need to get the maximum number of advertiser dollars or downloads.
Yes.
I know how to get the realignment to like 125,000 like listeners just like that.
Yeah.
I've done episodes, like for example, like Peter Zion. Did a Peter Zion episode.
Yeah.
350,000 views on YouTube.
Popped.
Yeah, it popped. Whenever we have like Eric Weinstein on, pops.
Yeah.
I think those are viable conversations, but I think what I'm more interested in is growing slowly and honestly feeding people their vegetables sometimes.
Yes.
So look, I want to do an episode. I'm doing an episode at some point in the next few months on like aircraft carriers. Cause like, I actually think like all I think about is like Taiwan.
Yes. Yes.
And the China crisis and all those different bits. And I keep thinking to myself like, man, like I wish I could have gone back and studied Ukraine and Russia and modern war back in 2017, 2018. Right. But I didn't.
And be aware.
I think people have that opportunity right now with like the Asia Pacific and naval power and those different bits. I want to be a podcast where someone is sort of like, oh, wow, that's like really useful. And like the win for me really was, okay, cool. I did this episode with Bridge Colby during my like daily Ukraine series. He's like a defense policy guy. A bunch of people messaged me. They're like, hey, like we're passing this around. Like, this is getting passed around Senate offices.
awesome.
Because it's just good. It's just like helpful. And like, that's like genuinely like what I want. Cause part of what I did when I like put away like politician Marshall,
yes,
was saying to yourself, like, okay, it feels really cool. Like, I get noticed when I go places.
That's really cool.
But, and I think this is to my credit.
Yes.
I was able to like take that feeling and say, okay, that's cute. Like, that's cool.
Yes.
But that's not what's most important to me. It's just not the thing. And guess what? Like, I'll get there in like 10 years.
Yes.
The question, and I think too many creators in our cohort are like not answering this question the right way.
Yes, it's absolutely true.
Like, there are so many people who are getting so big and so hyped, and like, I'm sort of like, there's just no there.
Right.
And you could say what you want about like the old system. You could say that Kara Swisher is just like not with that. I know people in tech don't like Kara Swisher. But when Kara Swisher was my age, she's writing two very good books about Amazon in the 1990s internet. She actually knew what she was talking for.
Yeah.
And what frustrates me is this current moment selects for people who are good at getting very big. And I basically hold the position, much as I say that, the set of politicians who are going to like really succeed and get us out of this are keeping their heads down and are basically not a part of the system. Right. I actually think like the defining like media personalities right now are not like optimizing themselves for going viral on TikTok.
Gotcha.
Because I actually think that TikTok is selecting for specific skill sets that aren't going to return for long-term value.
Much like our game.
Is that the whole like AOC optimizing her Instagram and not optimizing getting things done kind of thing?
Yeah, it's basically, and that's a good way to put it. I would, my advice for politicians, creators, like whatever, tech founders is like, hey, like really take a step back. Be arrogant. I'm arrogant. Like that's the nature of these spaces. Assume that like you're going to be successful in some way.
Yeah.
I've always assumed I'm going to be successful in some way. The real question to ask yourself is how are you going to get there?
Yes.
And what are you trying to do with that? If I did a like buzzy like podcast that got a lot of views, but wasn't passed around Senate offices during complicated moments, that would have like no actual purpose for me.
Right.
Because I just know given the growth of the podcast in 10 years, I'll be good enough, right? Like insert Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hour rule thing.
Exactly.
Then I'll be able to do both.
Yes.
But that's what I want to do. Like I want to be, the ideal end state for me is I can be maximally famous, but maximally competent. Important. And that means I'll be like 37, 38.
Yeah.
And people should ask themselves that because it's just sort of, it's so weird. Like, do you ever just like notice that? Like, it's like no one, like all these people, and this isn't to like dunk on web, they would all be like watching people flit from thing to thing, optimizing.
It's brutal.
It's lame and it doesn't work.
Yes,
and you watch people like not do it. I'm like not going to name names, but it's like very there if you're watching.
Yes.
I saw people go from like, I'm creator economy person. I'm metaverse person. I'm web three person. And now I'm climate tech person. And it's literally the lamest thing ever.
It is.
And what people don't realize is this is why the world is so weird, right? Not only are they not catching on when it comes to like the clicks and the views,
right?
But people in the know also notice this too.
That's a great point.
Everyone notices this. Like
the current thing guy.
Yeah. This is like the tech version. Like people are like, oh, the current thing, all Ukraine and COVID.
Yeah.
There's a tech version of the current thing, which is that. And the other problem here too is that like I think a huge problem in the industry is that, I mean, let's go there for a second.
Yeah.
There's the biggest red pill. This is my biggest red pill. I felt so self-conscious about my lack of like Twitter. I don't tweet.
Yeah.
But I'm really lucky in that like Sagar has a big Twitter. So I have 17,000 followers.
Yeah.
But that's just through Sagar retweet. I have the perfect amount. If I DM you, you will respond.
Yes, you don't have to worry.
If I got a blue check, I would just be like, I'd be boom.
Yeah,
just
I'm done. Set. Yeah.
But like I was so self-conscious about my lack of Twitter presence until I discovered that so many people in industry have other people write their tweets for them.
Really?
Oh yeah. Like that's a fascinating. Huge. And that helped me chill out.
It's like, okay.
I don't know if you guys had this experience, but one day I was like, man, like, how are these people who worked on tech in their 20s and 30s, comp sci degrees, how are they so fluent in all these topics?
They're
amazing writers. They have nuance. Because they're very well-paid 23-year-olds who are doing that for them.
They have their own
hustle departments. Yeah, I've discovered this in like, previously in video games that's like, how's everyone like doing all this marketing all the time? Oh, they pay people to do that.
Just pay somebody.
People do that. So like, that's just like the real, I want And what sucks is so many of these people who I'm implicitly like talking crap about, everyone here is obviously smart.
Right, exactly.
No one who I'm actually mentioning here is someone who I'm like, you meet them and you're like, man, like, what a dog. Like,
oh, no.
Like, yeah. None of like the super TikTok people. Actually, you know the person who's like most, who's threaded this needle? I will speak for Kyla Scanlon.
Oh, yeah.
Kyla is the only person who's mastered how do I get big on a platform where also being super, super deep. And that's because like Kyla is also like a three-sport athlete. She podcasts, she does YouTube, she writes, and she does TikTok. So like that's an example of someone who's able to say to themselves, she's like a super hard worker. Right. And also like, man, like I'm just like ranting now, so stop me. But like my other frustration with like the hustle stuff is too much of like hustle for people. This isn't like the usual hustle culture critique.
Yeah.
Too many people like define hustle as like just pumping stuff out.
Yes.
Like, how do I write like the perfect tweet thread, or how do I like clip this episode? Not just sort of like, for me, I read 3 to 4 books a week.
Yes.
Like that's my version of like hustle right now.
Yeah.
You know, if I wasn't doing that and I also wasn't tweeting, that'd be like a real bad thing. Yeah. But like, I really think like the 2020s for me, like, and the season of the next 50 years are just like, just get good at something. Just get good at something.
Really good.
Get a salary and just don't care about the views. Like
exactly.
The fact that I can make like a, you know, multi-six-figure salary just talking to people, it's like, that's insane. Like you ever read the old media world? Like you read like, all these people, they worked so hard. They didn't make any money.
Exactly.
No one read them. Just sort of just be okay with that.
Yeah.
And just understand that like people knowing you and the retweets, the dopamine hit doesn't last very long.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a longer, much longer game. So can we ever expect a senator or anything like that? What do you think?
No, obviously, no, here's what I'll put. Because I hate when people give like the fake answer on this. If I have something to say,
yes,
and I could add value, like I will run for office.
Gotcha. That's good.
But my real critique of Kozlov 2020 at Yahoo.com, Marshall, is he at a fundamental level had nothing to say,
right?
Nothing to add. And that's what I'm opposed to being.
You want
to
avoid that.
If there's a moment where there's an issue, but I know something about.
Yeah.
Oh, but this is good. This is where like, I think we'll end it. Like my favorite, the quote that I'm obsessed with right now is like, you know, Winston Churchill during the Blitz, he's talking to his son, Randolph Churchill. And he goes like, I see a way through. A way through this.
That's good.
Like things
that's
are at good. Their absolute worst.
Yes.
It's a disaster. He's like, I see a way through. And his answer was like, the US will get involved in the war. And that's how we're going to do it.
There's a path.
And that was the way through.
Yeah.
I have to see a way through to get involved in politics and then I'll do it. But, and this applies to everybody.
Yeah.
Think of like, what is your way through?
Right.
In any category that you're doing.
Yeah.
You want to be a Web3 poster? You know what? Like that could work for you.
That's good.
But like actually like push yourself, say to yourself, like, do I actually have something to say? Or am I just like taking the content of like the top 1% of people?
Yes, exactly.
Am I just like taking Gabby Goldberg's reading list and like turning into tweet form?
Yes.
That's not a way through.
Nope.
So don't do it.
Don't do it. I love that. I really love that. Well, Marshall, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find The Realignment? Where should we send them?
Yeah, so a couple of different things. So The Realignment is available wherever you listen to your podcast, Spotify, Apple, all those good things. We're also on YouTube. I've started to focus more on YouTube.
Nice.
Oh man, YouTube, we're extending here, but YouTube's scary. Because YouTube, there's an actual algorithm.
Yes, you can get wrecked. It's much easier than like the audio itself, I found. Like,
yeah,
you get
I want to say it's so much harder.
Yeah.
Because, well, fair. It's easier to like.
It's an odd trade off.
It's an odd trade off. The keywords, all those things matter. Yes. So, like, I've started to take it more seriously. So, people should definitely check out the YouTube. But yeah, that's the next can of worms. But yeah, The Realignment, all those other good things. I'm also on Substack.
Awesome.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Appreciate it, Marshall.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.